Welcome to Rethinking Trade with Lori Wallach, a podcast that unpacks international trade and how it affects you without putting you to sleep.
Welcome to Rethink Trade with Lori Wallach. I'm Lori Wallach. Today, as we hit the two-week countdown to the midterm elections, we're fortunate to get the lowdown from Celinda Lake and Mike Lux. Now, if you are at all interested in politics or economic justice, these are two folks who don't really need an introduction. Hell, if you watch cable news, you know who they are. But because they are two folks I greatly admire, let me brag on them just for a minute. Celinda Lake is one of the Democratic Party's leading political strategists. She was one of the two lead pollsters for the Biden campaign in 2020, and with her colleagues at Lake Research Partners, she's now polling for the Democratic National Committee, dozens of Democratic incumbents, challengers, all up and down the electoral process. And I personally have benefited from her research and her insights time and again. Mike Lux is co-founder of Democracy Partners, and he has worked with many of the most important institutions in the progressive community and on more presidential and other campaigns than most of us can remember. He was in the Clinton White House. He has done pretty much everything in politics and media. He's a great strategist. He's one of those people I go to advice when I find myself up a creek facing the trickiest campaign strategy questions. So what we're here to talk with these two amazing folks about is research that they've done that I personally think may well spell the answer to revitalizing democracy in this country. And I'm not being hyperbolic, because what we are talking about is how to make this country meet its promise and to achieve that by electing what beloved Paul Wellstone used to call the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, namely representatives, senators, and then 2 years again, the president, who is committed to making their lives better and delivering for them and their communities. So this body of work is called the Factory Towns Project. And I want to start with Mike and just ask him, what is a factory town and why is it important?
So we did a lot of research after the 2020 election, and a lot of pundits sort of go on and on about the Democrats and the working class, and most of these pundits have never met a working class person or know anything about their lives, and we really wanted to do a deep dive examination of what was going on in working class counties, especially those away from big metro areas. And one of the reasons for that is that we knew that over the last couple of election cycles, especially presidential election cycles, Democrats had really been hurt by votes in these sort of mid-size industrial counties that some people call the Rust Belt counties that used to do the bulk of manufacturing in our country and in the world, really.
So Mike, hold on there for 1 second, because you've just described what those towns are, but I want to actually dig in from the research itself what a factory town is with respect to what counties were actually the counties for this research. So it's a manufacturing heavy working class towns that are not part of huge urban areas, but are not farming dominated counties either. So these factory towns are two categories of them. You got the mid-sized ones with cities that have more than 35,000 in population, but that are not attached to the big urban areas. So medium-sized towns. Then you've got the smaller ones that are just as reliant on manufacturing, but they don't have any cities with so many people, no place like 35,000 people. Those two sets of counties, these factory town counties, those add up to 40% of all voters. 40%.
Those are places that Barack Obama actually won in 2012, mid-sized counties. When we added all these counties up, he had won them by about 100,000 votes net. But Hillary Clinton lost them by about 800,000 votes net. And Joe Biden didn't, in spite of being from Scranton, sort of a classic, right, factory town, even with that biography, even with that persona and brand, Joe Biden didn't do that much better. And so we knew there was something really deep that was going on in these places. And we really wanted to do a deep dive as to what was going on in these voters' lives, what was going on in terms of the economics, what was happening in the communities that was changing people's attitudes. And so that was the origin of the Factory Town Project. These are the places that have been most hard hit by deindustrialization and a number of the ills that have come with that.
Okay, so now regular Rethink Trade podcast listeners, you're figuring out why I'm so fascinated by this work and these findings. These are the towns that have lost a lot of manufacturing jobs thanks to our lunatic trade policies and the hyper-globalization that they delivered. And what this research found, among other things, replicated some other research that showed that the towns, the counties that lost a lot of manufacturing jobs, voted for Trump by much higher majorities. What this research has shown in others is that the towns that lost a lot of manufacturing jobs to bad trade agreements voted for Trump in much higher majorities. And we now have a situation where the rest of the country woke up to what these folks have been living with, which is when we all in the richest country in the world couldn't get the things that these folks used to make, because COVID's messed up all these distant supply chains, we kind of learned how wrong this whole system was. But people across these factory towns have been living this year after year, president after president, basically feeling betrayed. So, Celinda, you've done a lot of focus groups and polling and studied the results. And I'm wondering what you can tell us about the sentiment of people in these factory towns that, as Mike said, actually made the difference in why Trump won and are going to be the difference about, you know, what the Democratic Party is and what democracy in this country is going forward. What are they thinking?
So thank you so much, Lauren. Thank you always for your leadership. It's really a privilege to be on with you. You are one of my sheroes for sure in telling the truth as it is about the economy. And I really want to say how excited we are as a team. And the team is made up also in our shop of David Merman and Emily Garner to be part of this research, which we think is real breakthrough strategy. And as pollsters, we don't throw that term around casually. These voters, first of all, very, very upset, upset with their lives, upset about the future generation, upset about the economy. They are very populist. And they're very anti-corporation, big corporations. They're anti-CEOs. In fact, one fun note, we now have something to call Fox News. We want to call it corporate media from now on in. They are corporate media because these folks hate corporate media and hate corporate anything. They are very pro-labor unions and very trusting of labor unions on economic information, even though the unions have mostly left their areas. We have a lot to say to them. We need to be positive. We need to be forward-looking. We need to be local in our voice. But we need to talk about bringing jobs back from overseas, something you have been passionate and articulate about. Higher wages, bringing down healthcare costs, taxing wealthy corporations. But these folks want specifics, and they want proof. They are very, very sensitive to empty political rhetoric, and they think both parties specialize in empty political rhetoric. So they're looking for the proof. Show me the money, as they say. And we have an economic message that can be very, very powerful to these voters.
What is it that is motivating them the most? Just to stick with you for a second, Celinda, which is, you know, we hear a lot about the appeal to racism. We hear a lot about the appeal to othering people. When you boil down what folks in these factory towns are prioritizing, what they're voting on, what are their top concerns?
Well, you know, one of the things that's very interesting about racism, and Mike has some really interesting points that he makes on this. First of all, these factory towns and these small town America, and I come from rural Montana, small town America and rural America is getting increasingly diverse. So a third of these folks are people of color, and we should recognize that. And they're the friends and neighbors of each other in these communities. But what they're looking for is an economic narrative. And the foundations of some of the messages that really appeal to these voters are what was developed by Anant Shankar Osorio, who was very involved in this work as well, looking at populist economics, looking at the race-class narrative, uniting race and class, and saying they are trying to divide us because they want to keep and make economic gains. They don't want an economy that works for everyone. They want an economy that works for CEOs and shareholders, many of them located outside of the United States, not the hardworking people in local communities and these factory towns. So populist economics is our key, and we don't have often enough an economic message and a populist economic message like you frequently articulate.
So this is, in a way, what struck me as the most interesting and honestly the most inspiring part of this research, which is this was a cross-racial mix of people across the country. It worked basically on the lived experience of people in what had happened to them and their communities economically. And it was incredibly powerful, Mike, and seemed like against conventional wisdom, which is, you know, the Democrats are in the cities, the Republicans got the rural counties, you got to focus on the suburbs, which are kind of conservative, and that's where all the swings are, that's how you win or lose. And to me, and I'm wondering, Mike, if you can spell this out in a more sophisticated way than I just ham-handedly did, it seems that strategy-wise, you know, what Celinda's saying, spot on, which is you've got a racially diverse, basically class-based, to use the word we don't use very much in this country, appeal that is not about the othering, not about all of the mean, divisive stuff, but about the basic justice of making enough to support your family, having reliable healthcare, having a safe retirement. And this unites people. What'd you find?
Well, it does unite people. And you're absolutely right in terms of the strategy. Look, there are swing voters everywhere. There are swing voters in big cities. There are swing voters in the suburbs. There are swing voters in the most rural of counties. But the thing that we discovered was that Democrats were doing actually even better than the Obama years in big cities and in the big city suburbs. There were a lot of Republicans that turned out in those high turnout elections in 2016 and 2020 in the most rural counties. But where things really swung against us hard were in these industrial cities. That was the biggest swing against the Democrats. We're in precisely those places. Some of that swing came from people who switched their votes from Democrat to Republican. Some of the swing came from people who were just so discouraged and cynical and depressed about politics that they didn't vote. There was a lot of that too. Democrats need to re-engage with working class voters. And the best way, as Celinda was saying, the best way by far to do that is on economic issues. And, you know, you think about these folks' lives. They have been hard hit with factory closings. They've been hard hit with a lot of them have lost their pension. A lot of them used to make $20 an hour, and now they make $8 an hour. A lot of them have disabilities, work disabilities, or other kinds of disabilities. A lot of them have suffered, that they or their family have suffered from the opioid crisis. They are living tough lives, and unless someone is speaking to those kitchen table issues and talking to people about what's going to improve their lives, these folks are not going to listen. And I part of what makes me angry about some of the conventional wisdom is these folks are not on Twitter, right? They are not worried about who's more woke than who else, or, you know, what somebody is saying on Twitter about somebody else. Their lives are really tough. And they're looking for people who will address those issues. How do I get a good job again? How do we bring a manufacturer back to our city? how do I get, you know, healthcare that I can afford, right? Prescription drugs that I can afford. How does that happen for me? Those are the things that they are most focused on. And in our focus groups, those are the things that they kept coming back to and kept talking about.
The other thing about this that I would add that's really, really important is these folks assume right now, they keep their heads down low. They assume that they are completely surrounded by Trump supporters and completely surrounded by Republicans. And so they don't articulate an alternative point of view. They don't articulate the support for our candidates. And they don't call the question, wait a minute, Trump delivered tax cuts for Trump people who are sitting in Trump Tower, not people who are sitting in the Bozeman Hotel in Bozeman, Montana, where I come from. And this is a really, really important part of the equation. The social pressure aspect of this, where to tell people, yeah, they live in Republican areas that voted Trump, but 43% of their friends and neighbors are Republican or Democrats, and they don't think that. They think they're 4% if they're lucky, and they're going to keep their heads down low. So organizing at the local level and the kind of community that unions used to provide, where people could find like-minded people, people could find the experts who would call into question these kinds of economic policies that make no sense, is a very, very important piece of the equation as well.
And let me just step in too. What Celinda said about community building is so important. These folks are desperate for community. They've had 2 years where they didn't get together with their friends. They've seen their communities sort of deteriorating, and you know, the newspaper is laying off people, so they don't know what's going on in their own hometown. And they're desperate for that sense of community and, you know, and fellowship, to use an old an old word. And part of what I think we as a political movement, not just a political party, but as a political movement, we need to provide people a chance to rebuild community and to re-engage with their neighbors. And I think that's such an important part of all of this.
So the thing I keep trying to interject is the math of this, because the moral case is, you know, you just can't contest it. But also the bottom line, as the Factory Towns report underscores, is that while Democrats have picked up something like 1.5 million votes in big cities in the 10 states that were at the heart of this study, which are, you know, the big swing states, and that overcame the like almost 600,000 votes that Democrats lost in rural counties, the real losses, the way that Clinton lost and Trump won, is in these small and mid-sized manufacturing counties, which, you know, it was a combined shift down of 2.6 million votes. And when you sort of think of that, you know, that is counterintuitive to sort of the narrative of either demographics are gonna win out for Democrats, et cetera. It really is getting the Democratic Party to represent what, you know, is the base of a Democratic Party I want to be a part of, which is one that represents the interests of the majority of working people who, as you said, have really had a crap time in our economy through Democratic and Republican presidents alike. So you guys have, you guys like intuited early on, before it was cool, that, and it's one of the reasons I admire and love you guys, that these policies that shipped away 5 million plus manufacturing jobs and all of the offshoring and gutting wide swaths of whole states that used to make everything this country needed, that you guys knew, you had a gut instinct, it was dangerous, it was super unfair, and for a long time you've been saying it's bad politics. And now this data has just, you know, empirically proved that your instincts were really prescient. So here is the big question, which is, as a practical matter of both policies and politics, what does this amazing research, and folks, everyone should read it. It's Factory Towns, the Factory Towns Project. It's worth reading. There's slides you can look at. It really is eye-opening. So what does that amazing work tell both of you is the best way forward. Because again, not to sound hyperbolic, but I kind of feel like not just making sure our country is the place we want it to be, but the future of our democracy pretty much relies on what you guys learned. What's the way forward?
So the first thing I would say is articulating an alternative economic vision. And it has to be an economic vision that is really serious about taking on corporate and CEO power in this country, and taking on trade policies, taking on bringing manufacturing back to the heartland, taking on taxes and the way that our tax policy works. And look at the Republicans already 2 days ago said, we're going to reinstate the Trump tax cuts if we get in. They don't even win yet, and they're back at it. We're going to cut Social Security. We're going to make sure you can't unionize when unions are favorable. We need more of the CHIPS programs and the energy programs that this administration has forwarded and that our Democratic governors in these states. We also need to be less intimidated. One of the things we did in this survey, and I really credit Mike with this, is we were tough on ourselves. We just didn't find the, oh, feel good messages. We attacked ourselves on all of the cultural attacks that they are running against us. And our populist economic messages, way more powerful than the cultural attacks. In a vacuum, those cultural attacks matter. When you're offering a common sense economic policy that's going to build this country back from the middle, that trumps, excuse the expression, the cultural attacks that they like to put out all the time.
Yeah, I think just to build on what Celinda was saying, I think the bottom line is that Democrats need to be less mushy, is the word I would say, on economics. And I run into this. Celinda and I actually recently co-authored, along with a couple of other people, a column about the importance of talking about economics at the end of the election. And we should have done better as a party talking about it through the last 2 years. Because when you think about the kinds of policies that the Biden administration has been pursuing, they are really beneficial to working class America. The Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act, all of these different things have done such great things for working class folks, and we're going to be able to build on that in the future. But too many Democrats, and I think maybe they're worried about making big contributors mad. Maybe they're worried about some of the corporate PACs and whether some of that. But they just get mushy when it comes time to talk about economics. We need to have, as Celinda said, we need to have a vision about economics that we articulate over and over and over again. That comes down on what's on one side. It's the old labor thing. Which side are you on, right? We need to show folks that we are on their side, and we need to do that with specifics. One of the things in the focus groups that was really striking is when we showed them kind of a typical political ad that had generalities in it. People were not interested in that. When we showed them something specific about specific policies that would improve their lives, they perked up. So we need to show people that we're serious about their lives and that we're serious about rebuilding the economy and communities that have been devastated by deindustrialization.
Really important insights: being specific, being clear, being bold in how a policy will actually deliver benefits. Those are all the things that are winning for people who've had a hard time, who are looking for a different way. And a practitioner of that, I think we've all seen and admired, is Sherrod Brown, a guy who gets elected statewide in Ohio. Your research and what Senator Sherrod Brown has done is the ample evidence this. Folks, I want to flag for you the article that just got mentioned. It's in the American Prospect. It's a memo to Democratic candidates. Please, they get the message in these closing 2 weeks, and the outcome of this election is good. It's also our path forward for the presidential election. It's the only path forward. It's the necessary path forward, and so much is at stake. Everyone says each election is the most important, but really now democracy is truly at stake. And as far as which side folks are on, Mike Lux and Celinda Lake have been on the side of working people and democracy and economic justice through and through. So thank you both so much in this countdown to the election for sharing some time and effort. And folks, please read this study, the Factory Towns Project. And for every person you give money to politically, for every member of Congress or senator, local official you talk to, pass on the word. This is the path forward. And we have to thank these folks and their partners in this research for doing this really valuable work. Folks, everyone, spread the word. And thank you, Celinda and Mike. And in 1 week's time, stay tuned, because we're going to have Ben Beachy from the Blue-Green Alliance talking to us about some of the specific policies that we're seeing this administration trying to enact to rebuild our manufacturing, our ability to make stuff and to give good jobs to folks across the country, but also to adjust to make the clean, green energy, cars, and products that we're going to need to save our planet from the climate crisis. That's next on Rethinking Trade with Lori Wallach.